The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to The Guardian Football Weekly. Today's show is a special on mental health. It's something we've been planning to do for a while. After the tragic death of Manchester City youth team player Jeremy Whiston last month, mental health in football came into focus for a day or two. People tweeted their sadness and then the news cycle carried on. But what help is there for footballers? Whose responsibility is it to help youngsters with dreams of making it who are let go? And how much support do players get through their careers? And beyond football, we all say it's important to talk about it, but is that enough? What practically should we all be doing to look after our own mental health and that of people around us, especially during a national lockdown? This is The Guardian Football Weekly. On the panel today, Barry Glendenning, hello.
Hello, Max.
Archie Rinter, who spoke so well about his experiences a few months ago. Hi, mate, thanks for doing this.
Hi, Max.
Marvin Sordell, friend of the pod, former Watford, Bolton, Burton striker, amongst others, who played for the England under-21s, for Great Britain in the London Olympics, retired at 28, is now a filmmaker, a writer, and part of the FA's Heads Up campaign. Is that enough things to be doing, Marvin? How are you?
That's a lot of things, yeah.
that's all we have time for today. Alex Mills is the head of education at Sporting Chance. Hi, Alex.
Hi, Max. Thanks for having me, guys.
A pleasure. Can you briefly, Alex, explain to those who don't know what Sporting Chance is and what you do?
Yeah, Sporting Chance, Max, was the charity set up by Tony Adams. A lot of people, certainly on this pod, will be familiar with Tony. Tony addressed his issues with alcohol in 1996, set up Sporting Chance in the year 2000. So we're 20 years old this year. Initially as a day rehab for sports people, particularly footballers, suffering from issues with problematic behaviour and addiction relating to alcohol, other drugs and gambling. And then in 2011, we opened that out to a nationwide counselling service. So footballers or current or retired athletes from a range of different sports, we work with 16 stakeholders over 11 different sports, can receive tailored help for any emotional or mental health problem. And for 90% of our client base, that's going to see a talking therapist within 45 minutes of their home club or training base. Or at the moment, obviously, that's very much an online operation. In terms of our support to footballers specifically through the PFA, we're able to support any PFA member with any emotional or mental health problem. And that PFA membership is for life. It's a very comprehensive support package offered through the player union.
And actually on that note, before we start, I think it is important to say that this is a very sensitive subject. It will deal with some very serious issues. If you are really struggling, we'll give out a number of professional organisations who can help. We'll do that a couple of times in the pod, and we urge you to use them if you think you need to. And this show wasn't necessarily prompted by the story of Jeremy Whiston, but it's a very sad one and it deserves our time. He was part of Manchester City's academy between 2016 and 2019. He had a knee injury. That was the part of the reason that he was let go. His parents told the Manchester Evening News, "We're very grateful for the opportunity that Manchester City gave our son." Speaking to the Times, Jeremy's father, Manila, said, "I can only speak for my son, but he suffered while he was at City and after he left there. I want to highlight the issue that kids in football need to be taken care of mentally." Since Jeremy took his own life, Manchester City has formalised its system of dealing with young players who enter the club's training academy system but do not join professional ranks. City officials say they will now check in on those who are dropped, telephoning them once a month for 6 months. Wellbeing screenings with sports psychologists will also be conducted with players aged 12 or over. One of Jeremy's friends, Alex, said, "I don't think the club could have done any more, to be honest. We have lots of access to psychologists. How long is a club supposed to support somebody for? I think this was a total shock to everyone." Marvin, in part one, really like to focus on your experiences. And you tweeted at the time, "This is such tragically sad news. We have to do so much better in the world and in the football industry." You've spoken a lot about your mental health while you were playing. Is that why you retired?
It's one of the biggest reasons, yeah. I mean, it was a massive contributing factor at the time because football is a very complicated industry that many from the outside don't understand and don't probably see a lot of the things that come with it and the emotional roller coaster that you go on every single day. And I think one of the biggest factors for me with that was the fact that my emotions were so tied into my workplace, and my workplace was a place that I wasn't able to leave because my identity was my job. And so 24/7, I'm who I am as on the pitch. That is my whatever happens on the pitch is who I am. And that was a very unhealthy way for me to be living. And I got to a point in my life where I started to realize that that wasn't very good for me. As much as I love playing football, I love being a football player, and it was my dream, it wasn't healthy for me to continue to go down this path. So I needed to make a decision that was going to allow me to be freer and happier.
Looking back, did you think you kind of struggled with your mental health from the start of your career? And is it something you realized at the time or not?
I think it's something that's very common in football, and a lot more common than people will potentially even accept. You know, it's not something that players want to talk about or potentially even say that that was the case themselves. You know, I've had a lot of conversations with a lot of players over the last few years, particularly since I retired, and many players have said the words "I'm struggling" or "I was struggling," as opposed to, you know, "I had a mental health problem," or, you know, they start saying, you know, I was just drinking every day, or I was just gambling a lot, and they speak about it in such a nonchalant way. And for someone who's been through those experiences and those emotional depths, I guess, I can see that in somebody else, and I can see that they're treating it in a way that I did. Except, you know, as time went on, I started to realize, and then I was able to then address it in a way. But I definitely think it's something that's so common that happens to football players throughout their journeys, because emotionally it's such an interesting environment. Whereas most workplaces don't have high pressure and lots of emotion. You know, it's either one or the other. You know, most people go to work with either they're driven completely by emotion, or they're pushed by emotion on you know, that's the main thing, or their main outlet is the main thing that pushes them, makes them have to work and be productive and do their job very well, is the financial side of things. Football sits in the middle, where it's very much a lot of both. It's a very, very emotive and emotional environment. You know, when you think about fans and you think about managers and coaches and staff and the environment of football and a football match, but then it's high, high business. And so when you kind of combine those two, it makes a really strange environment to work in.
And what kind of support was there as a young player?
As a young player, I don't ever recall there being anything there, to be honest. You know, Watford were great as a club in the sense that they had a psychologist in the club, but like in general, beyond Watford, at other clubs I've played for around that time, and I had friends at other clubs, it wasn't really a situation that it was a common thing for players to even have those discussions. And even at the time, the psychologist at Watford, people would do everything they could to avoid speaking to him. And that was just a normal thing. And you'd hear it from the older players. So you'd hear it from the younger pros you were in contact with, and then the scholars who'd been there before. So as a first year scholar, you think, right, nobody wants to speak to this guy. So I probably shouldn't be the only one speaking to this guy, because it's just weird, because everybody, the environment makes it out that it is a weird thing to do.
I guess part of that environment as well is shaped by the clubs themselves. And even if they are trying to have sessions, I was listening to David Cotterill on Ellis James and John Robbins's How Do You Cope podcast. And one of the things that he said, which I really found interesting, was how if you have one of these sessions towards the end of the day for a footballer, then a lot of the time, like, most of the lads are just going to want to go home. If you don't make it central, if it is not given priority by senior figures at the club, then it's difficult. You have to create an environment within this, I would say, very unique environment that football is as well, where players are going to feel comfortable. And I think, like, Marvin knows what dressing rooms are like more than I do, but I think that's a very difficult dynamic to make people feel comfortable that they can raise their voice. You need to get them in more isolated and confined environments to really find out what's going on. Because if you ask someone to raise their hand in a dressing room and express themselves, that's a very different thing to expressing how you're actually feeling in person to someone.
Marvin, you say that Watford, a lot of players would go out of the way not to have any dealings with the psychotherapist. Is that because it was seen as a sign of weakness or just because they felt they didn't need to?
It was probably more the case that you don't want to be seen as, you know, you're talking to him because you've got something wrong. It's not just a general checkup. And as Archie was saying, it's very much to do with the environment, because, you know, whenever I discuss mental health, I say mental health, physical health, it's the same thing. It's something that lives on a scale and is consistently moving depending on your environment, depending on what happens, you know? So as with our health, if we're constantly going to a Chinese buffet and eating rubbish food and putting bad things into our body, our physical health is going to deteriorate. And we get to a point where we look in a mirror or we feel something within us and we think, right, we need to make a change because this doesn't feel good. And I need to do what I need to do to get better. So you go to the gym, you exercise, you get personal training, you start to eat better, et cetera, et cetera. And with our mental health, we kind of just get to that point where we just start to indulge in the ways. Sometimes it's through addiction, sometimes it's anxiety, sometimes it's depression. It's the emotional things that we indulge in as opposed to physical things more so. And we just ignore them. Instead of thinking, right, my emotional health is deteriorating, I need to do what I can to make it better. And it's the same thing as on the other side of the scale, is that if you are in excellent condition physically, you know, we all know that that's not going to just stay that way unless you maintain it. So if we have excellent emotional health and mental health, how do we expect it to just stay like that forever without ever working on it?
Marvin, how bad did things get for you, and can you articulate how that felt?
I mean, my worst point was a suicide attempt. You know, I've been very open about that, and I'm open about that because I think it's important for people who are, I guess, at that point to see that there's light at the end of the tunnel, because I didn't see that there was light at the end of the tunnel, but I also didn't see that there was anybody around that struggled. You know, I struggled a lot, and you know, I still struggle now sometimes. It's a feeling of just being completely lost and void of everything, really, of internal feelings. It just didn't, it felt like I'd been going up and down for so long in terms of my emotions, particularly with it being so, everything emotional for me was so tied into football, and I was just going up and down, just crashing up and crashing down consistently. And I got to a point where I just crashed at the bottom. And it just, everything just splattered everywhere. And then there was just nothing left. And that's pretty much how I can explain how it felt.
And how did you sort of get out of that situation? I
don't really know, to be honest. I did try to consciously make some changes. But I think the thing that was the catalyst was starting to write. Because that was the first time that I was able to, I guess, get my emotions out in any way. But then also it enabled me to reflect on those emotions at any given time. And then also share those emotions with family and friends, because I wasn't great at sharing them through speaking and having conversation, because I didn't know how to bring that up in conversation. I didn't know what I would say, or I didn't know how it would be taken. So I just didn't address them or didn't have those conversations. So yeah, that was my path, I guess.
What strikes me just from listening to you, Marvin, and having heard other stories from footballers as well, is just how lonely a place it can be being a professional footballer. And I think it's underestimated by the intensity of the media coverage that you have to face, for example, but also just like not being able, like, who do you trust in that environment? Because can you go to your manager? Probably not, because maybe the chances of you being able to go to your manager have now increased these days with the environment. But I'd imagine when you were coming through, the chances are, is you're thinking, if I go to him, then he's going to see this as a sign of weakness. He's not going to play me. He'll banish me to the reserves. And then I guess there's the there's the perception of money from the outside as well, and what that does. And you're thinking, are people around me just clinging on for the job I'm here for, or are they here for me as a person? And the more and more these things swirl, I think, as a person in your head, it's a difficult cycle to get out of.
Extremely. And I think a lot of that is tied up in identity as well, because when you think that for most football players who've been doing this since they were 6, 7, 8 years old, that's all you've probably ever been known for. All I was ever known for growing up was that I played football and I was all right at football. And if you think that for your whole existence is based around what you can offer on a football pitch, and changing rooms are the same. They're quite an unforgiving and quite a strange environment in that sense as well. So, you know, how popular someone is in a dressing room often reflects in how good they are as a player, which is really strange, but that it is like that. And when, as a player, you think that is all who you are, and that's all the only way that people will love or respect you, and maybe things are not going so well, that very much eats away at you.
Alex, you've been sort of nodding along very patiently so far, and we're going to get into more of what you do and more of what football can do. I just wondered what your reaction is to Marvin's story.
I'm nodding along vigorously because everybody in this conversation is speaking my language, really, the language that I've come to understand in the world that I work in, and that's actually incredibly uplifting. Marvin's story, when I listen to it, like I listen to any story of a professional sports person struggling with their emotional and mental health, whether you take that as a positive thing, the increasing number of sports people that are coming out and disclosing problems with their emotional and mental health as a good or a bad thing is part of an age old debate, really. I would say it's undoubtedly a positive thing, and stories like Marvin are engendering cultural change within the industry and within wider society in general. But that said, there's an element of sadness when I hear Marvin's story, in that services that would have helped Marvin sooner and perhaps enabled Marvin to go through less pain than he needed to, and to put it in the best way that I can, weren't there and weren't made available to him as soon as they could have been. And I think, you know, I'd say that things are changing for the better, and they're changing quickly.
Can you tell us a bit about the Heads Up campaign before we end part one, Marvin?
Yeah, I mean, I've been involved in it from the very beginning in a lot of different ways. And I did an interview right at the beginning with the Community Shield when it kicked off there. And then did a lot of interviews. I helped consult on some things. I was also part of the documentary with Prince William. And I think, I mean, the amazing thing about that campaign, which I said throughout the time, is that it has really brought to the forefront a conversation that is so important. And I think, I mean, this year has just made it even more so important and highlighted how important a discussion it is and how important mental health is. But to have someone of you know, Prince William's stature take it upon himself to really bring the entities of football together, which is I don't think is a very common thing for all the governing bodies in football to work together in a very gracious manner, I say. So for them to do that obviously is an amazing thing, but it showed how important it is. You know, it showed how important it is in the fact that they wanted to have such a wide scale discussion. Maybe they were forced into doing so because he's going to be king. Who knows? But, you know, I think it's so important that it happened, you know, and hopefully it's not the end. You know, I had a conversation with him, Prince William, that is, for the documentary, and we spoke about the Heads Up campaign. And of course, it was a season long campaign. And I said, well, what's beyond that? because it's important to know that we're still going to try to keep raising awareness and try to keep this conversation going.
If any of what you've heard in part one resonates with you, there is help out there. In the UK and Ireland, Samaritans can be contacted on 116 123, or you can email joe@samaritans.org in the UK or joe@samaritans.ie in Ireland. In the US, the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline is 1-800-273-8255. And in Australia, the Crisis Support Service Lifeline is 131114. Other international helplines can be found at befrienders.org. We'll include all the links to those organisations on the Guardian website, and we'll be back in a second. Welcome to part two of the Guardian Football Weekly. Alex, as we said, head of education for Sporting Chance. So, right to say you work with Premier League and EFL clubs academies, providing mental health teaching to players from 14 and upwards. Is that right?
Yeah, as part of a group of providers, Max, with both those leagues, providing education around emotional and mental health. So Sporting Chance is probably more focused on 16s to 23s at academy level. And also we do provide education to first team groups as well. And over the last 20 years that we've been in existence, starting with Tony going into Manchester United with Alex Ferguson when we first started, right through to the present day, continuing to go into first teams on a kind of ad hoc basis when we're invited. That changed last year due to a new Premier League ruling that came in that actually made it a requirement for clubs to provide mental health education to their first team squads. That was a big development in terms of the conversation that we're having on this pod. And actually Marvin came and joined one of our facilitators, a brilliant therapist and former player, a guy called Paul Mortimer, who some will be familiar with on this pod, no doubt. And they did a brilliant piece down at West Ham at the start of last season. Unfortunately, that's the few visits that we've managed to get underway was really successful, but the program was put on hold, obviously due to the current environment. But very much looking forward to getting that back underway with Premier League first teams whenever the situation allows us to get into clubs. But yeah, our bread and butter is academy delivery from 16 to 23, Max.
And have you found clubs and have you found players wanting to engage more with you? Marvin was talking about, you know, nobody wanted to talk to the psychologist and, you know, the idea in a dressing room, people wouldn't put their hands up. Have you seen, as this conversation becomes sort of more frequent and the sort of the stigma is broken down a little bit, have you seen players engage more?
There's two. I mean, the way of measuring that is twofold for us, really, Max. One is players communicating to us during a session or following a session, and to enable that to happen, you've got to design a session which ultimately involves players, gets players talking to each other about their own mental health, as well as engaging with facilitators like Paul. And when you're engaging with players on that level, you tend to get a lot more out of them. And we certainly see those in our sessions. The other way of measuring that, Max, is by looking at the amount of people that are coming through to our confidential helpline, and that's increased again this year. We supported over 1,200 sports people in 2019. Obviously, COVID's had an impact this year, but again, we expect those numbers to be high this year, and also younger players coming to us from the academy environments that we are providing education to, and also players coming to us to have a conversation about how they're feeling, as opposed to coming to us at crisis point. And I think right. Poignant story highlights is the different points that people can come to a Sporting Chance to ask for help, and obviously it's a lot easier and a lot more effective to address issues when people are coming to us earlier and having that conversation about how they're feeling and practical changes that they can make at an earlier point.
Question from Dan. Does football and by extension all elite sport conflate mentality and mental health? And how much confusion does that cause when trying to source like appropriate well-being support for athletes who need it? I don't know, does that make sense?
As in, I'm assuming what he means is...
Well, we constantly hear, oh, your players have got to have the right mentality. You've got to be a strong mentality. You've got to be, to be up for this game. And that is a different thing to mental health.
Yeah, they're two completely different things. Someone who's... And I think that's something that we, maybe as society, people, definitely football as an industry needs to learn and understand that they're two completely different things. So because somebody might have a mental health problem that stems from their relationship at home, that doesn't mean they're not strong enough mentally to play a game of football. It doesn't mean that whatsoever. It is just, somebody might have childhood trauma that they're dealing with, and that doesn't mean they're not mentally strong enough to play football. They're two completely different things. So it's impossible to see how they could correlate.
Matt says, what's been done within clubs on providing access to mental health support and ongoing care? We hear a lot about it's okay not to feel okay, but testimony from players like Danny Rose and others often show the reality of the support is different. What do you think, Alex? Do you think it is different, or do you think it's... I get the impression it's changing for the better.
Without doubt. The service is very good, should be very good. And we're constantly striving to improve, and constantly as part of kind of the four principles that we've outlined that we work to as a charity, constantly moving towards parity between mental health and physical health within sport, and also the ideal that no one within a sporting environment is discriminated against because of their mental health. Are we there yet? No. And until we are, then there's always work to be done as far as we're concerned.
Yeah, I mean, obviously this is a football podcast, but it's important to remember football doesn't have a monopoly on macho culture. I'd argue football journalism is similar. We've all heard about the antics in the communications department at the Tory party in the last few days. But... Footballers seem to be particularly well catered for in this regard, like as in the option to get help is there if they need it. But I'm conscious of the fact that, like gambling, depression is a disease you can hide, I think. And correct me if I'm wrong, because it's not something I've suffered from, but you can present a sunny side to the outside world while simultaneously being at an incredibly low ebb and in a really dark place. And from what I've read, the awful case of Jeremy Whiston, that apparently the facilities at Manchester City, available to young players are second to none. So how can you persuade players to seek help if they need it but don't particularly want it?
That must be, I think what you say there, Barry, is part of the question. Particularly just building on what Alex was saying as well with the pressure and the money. I think football suffers from the money in a sense because of, in comparison to say rugby union and rugby league players coming through, they earn less and therefore you have to plan ahead for the future more. Whereas because of the money you can earn in football, I think it can encourage you more to a one-track plan. And I think as well, there's a paradox with the pressure of being an academy player and indeed an academy coach, where with young players, you always are seeing positive reinforcement over and over again of being like, yeah, no, you're good enough, you're good enough, you're good enough. And then one day you're told, bang, you're not good enough. And you're out in the cold. And that's a very difficult situation to deal with as a coach, just in terms of being aware of the language that you're using alone. So there's so much that draws into this.
And I presume you can hide this, right? You can appear to be fine and not be fine. And I don't know what the answer is of how to get through to people who aren't yet willing to want to talk about it.
Yeah, very much so. You can hide it. And, you know, from my personal perspective, that was something that I did. In terms of how we can encourage players more so to have these discussions and to seek help, it's more about creating the environment that it's fine to do so. Because I think that currently doesn't exist en masse within football. Of course, I think it exists in specific clubs, and individuals have created those environments within those clubs. But in general, I don't think it exists within football. So it's about creating that environment. And I think that very much comes from top down.
Do you think, we talk about, you know, Jeremy Whiston and being let go, and this issue of, as Archie mentioned, of being out in the cold, and what clubs, you know, what is a club's responsibility to carry on a conversation for how long with an individual they've let go? You know, they need to focus on the players they've got at their club. They want to win things.
I think it's fair to point out, Max, that Manchester City did have a facility in place where they do stay in touch with players who've been let go and offer them support.
Sure.
My point is, if the player doesn't want that support, then I'm not sure what more you can do.
You need to incentivize somehow the being multifaceted, being about more than just football. Because I think that's, from speaking to somebody who's high up at a Premier League academy, it's historically something that the Europeans do better than in England, creating that value of education, of non-performance living. And that is something I think in England where it's been, where if you've got football, then you've got everything. But actually, you don't. You need, I think that for the majority of people, because look, there are 3,000, I think, players across the Football League. And as a percentage of people who go into academies, that is a tiny percentage who make it. We need to perhaps be more realistic even in the media about what it takes to actually be one of those players, because it's the chances of you making it are small. And yet I think the vision that can be sold from the outside is that, oh, you can make it, you can dream. And whilst you want to encourage people to dream, you also need to encourage a sense of realism and realize that it's, you need to look after the majority. But in a world where it is high performance and you're always told how cutthroat it is, it is a difficult balance trying to marry that, trying to get that level of performance, and then you need to take care of them as well. But that there needs to be more of that pastoral, I think, emphasis on it in terms of the system.
Just to add to that, I think, you know, the aftercare package that currently exists, the what, you know, what we're thinking about helping players beyond their football career in terms of getting released, you know, young players in particular, it's a way to fix the problem now, but it's not a long-term solution to the problem. The problem is, as Archie said, it's to do with the education, it's to do with identity, very much so. You know, I've mentioned that quite a few times now, and I think that's probably the biggest thing, is that within football, it's creating that environment that allows people to be more than just a football player throughout their careers. And so they are not overly reliant on one thing to fulfill them in life completely. And once you lose that, when you're not ready to lose that, then it's no wonder that so many really struggle to deal with that, because it's all they've ever known for their entire lives, and then it's just taken away in a click of the fingers. And they've never been told to, or even sometimes allowed to, prepare for that moment.
I think you get pigeonholed as well, Max, a lot. We talk a lot about average footballer stereotypes. You read that somebody is not your average footballer. Mm-hmm. And I don't think that actually saying that, by saying average footballer, that's perpetuating a very old stereotype of somebody who is uneducated and comes from a working class background, when actually we want to create a wide berth there. You don't want to be pigeonholing them, but we see time and time again in the media that happens.
One of the things that sticks out for me, Marvin coming out and telling his stories as a number of other current and former players have recently is really important, and it sends out a really strong message, not only to say in general, but specifically to footballers, that it's okay to do that, and it's okay to get in touch with your thoughts and feelings and talk about your thoughts and feelings and process them. But actually, if there is an attitude out there that it's not okay for footballers to think that, what problems do footballers have, because they have money, they're doing a job that they love, and they shouldn't have anything to worry about. And that's something that needs to change culturally, societally, in order for footballers to feel more comfortable at addressing help, and for them to feel that they're justified and have permission to have problems too, and to talk about those problems and address those problems. And I think also culturally, the other thing is within clubs, I think Archie's hit the nail on the head, is that push and pull between performance and welfare. And actually, you were talking about how are things improved from an emotional mental health perspective. From my perspective, working for Sporting Chance, massively. We're welcomed into academy structures and supported, and you know, the player care staff standing up at the front of the class when we go into to deliver our seminars will be encouraging and encourage the players to listen and buy into our education sessions, but actually that attitude needs to be replicated throughout the entire club, throughout the performance, the performance staff and the coaching staff as well. And what I would say is, what those members of staff, a lot of members of staff within football clubs, are purely focused on performance, and they work and are paid in order to nurture and produce players, and that will be their main focus. So you've got to, within their jobs, give them goals and make it part of their job description to develop other areas of players' lives, including their emotional and mental well-being.
Finally, for part two, and I don't know what the answer to this question is, Marvin, but how do we strike a balance between letting a kid like have a dream who's been asked to an academy at 7, 8, or 9, and just letting a child be allowed to be a child and grow up?
Or how that situation is normally put to young players is normally they have to give everything completely to become, you have to give everything to become a professional football player. And often with that comes the people on the other side who say, you know, what happens if you don't make it? You need to have a backup plan, which, you know, is a sensible thing to say, but I think it's not said in the right way. And so to allow these kids to have a dream, but also to be normal and to explore other things, I think should be something that they're encouraged to do. And football is not something that you can do forever. It's not a game that you can play forever. That's just, you know, it's not one of those jobs.
I'm trying, Marvin.
It's not one of those jobs that you can have until 40, 50, 60. And as you go older, you continuously get paid more, and you're progressing in that. You know, it's something that you're going to have to leave, and you're going to have to start another career in another industry. So players should be encouraged throughout to think about that. And you think a player will spend about 10 years working towards becoming a professional, but some will spend zero towards their next career, which doesn't make any sense.
It's just a really weird industry when you think about it. From the point of view that, you know, somebody's very young when they're 21, but at 32, you're just over the hill. And just from that kind of point of view as well, the way you, like, your life is prismed and shaped, it must be ridiculous.
And also actually the fact that, you know, most people working in an office would find it quite uncomfortable if kind of their manager just employed somebody else and sat them next to them in the office and kind of said, they're just there in case you make a mistake and they're replacing you next week, but don't worry about it. Yeah. Do you know what I mean? It isn't working in a bank. And look, there are lots of different jobs with unique challenges. I imagine if you're a North Sea fisherman, you know, being outside in 40-foot waves trying to catch cod has its own impact on your emotional and mental health. But, you know, we're focused on football, working with the footballing stakeholders to make changes at the top, because change at the top is the heads up campaign that Marvin's been talking about, the mental health football charter. They are important in terms of, Max mentioned it earlier, changing things from the top and having people with real clout and responsibility with a football club, making changes and enforcing those changes throughout the entire club in order to engender lasting and sustainable change.
I would say to Alex that cod stocks in the North Sea have plummeted in recent years, and you would be better off fishing for that particular breed elsewhere.
And that is where we'll end part two. Obviously, most people listen to this aren't professional footballers, so we'll broaden out the conversation to football fans and the rest of us in just a second. Welcome to part three of the Guardian Football Weekly. Archie, you've spoken in the past on this pod. I thought you were really brave when you came on and you spoke about the fact you'd been off for quite a while. I just wondered what you... It felt to me like there was a really positive response to you coming on and talking about it. I wonder how you felt about doing it and how you felt about the reaction.
It was more than I imagined. It was more than I imagined, and it actually brought with it its own set of luxury problems where I was putting myself under a lot of mental pressure to respond to all these messages. And then I was realizing, hang on, just realistically, you can't, like, or else you will be going on forever. And like, it was overwhelming, I have to say. But I'm exceedingly grateful for the support, and every now and then somebody checks in and says how it's helped them, and that obviously means a lot. But look, for me, I'd love it more than anything else if this topic could just become normalized more, as if this could be treated more like physical health. I did it because I didn't think that I thought I had a chance with my platform on here to normalize it a touch as well. So ultimately, that's got to be the aim. And I think that having conversations like this on here will hopefully help maybe one or two more people out there to think about going and seeking out help.
It's interesting we talk about, you know, sort of putting on a sunny disposition and not necessarily always feeling like that. You know, in my mind, that you're either eating a kebab from Lucas Podolski's kebab shop or going down a water slide or both at the same time with a poster of Johnny English behind you. You know, sort of generally, how are you doing?
Yeah, like when Barry said that earlier about this idea of having a sunny disposition and then what's going on behind you is or what's going on in reality is not, that feels like I kind of in my head was like, yep, over here. that's one. It's going better, but I just have had to learn to take life a lot slower and value that and value routine, which is very difficult in a freelance job, when your sleeping patterns are all over the place, you're traveling here, there and everywhere. And as a result, your diet is gone. You don't know when you're going to exercise as well. It's difficult to, it's difficult to form meaningful relationships as well. As I know you're too keen on.
It's a different podcast, that one.
That is, isn't it? I can say that all's good on that front right now for me anyway.
Oh, that's a breaking news. Excellent.
Right. But look, like it's like things are a lot more stable. And things like, yoga have helped iron me out a bit, and And it's just finding little healthy things in my routine, just actually finding a routine has been a big help. But it is such a thing of just putting one foot in front of the other and trying to find joy in small things that you didn't know you could before. Like, I mean, for me, there's a group of green parrots in Cologne that fly around my local area. And I find that a very soothing image to see. So because it's not the sort of thing you expect in Cologne. So yeah, you like the more I can take value out of the smaller things in my life, I find the healthier my mind is as well.
Barry, I'm not going to accuse you of having a sunny disposition, but you tweeted the other day when you were sort of talking about this pod that lockdown had, you felt a bit down, and I you know, it is a sliding scale, and I know when we go to a pub after two or three pints and I try and get deep and meaningful, you tell me to fuck off, but I just wondered how you're doing.
Oh, I'm fine. I mean, I had a quite a big response to that, and I felt slightly embarrassed by it because I don't have depression. I don't think I have mental health problems. I just struggling slightly with this lockdown compared to the last one, because I think the last one was a bit of a novelty, whereas this one I'm just bored. And at one point last week, I think apart from doing two podcasts, I hadn't actually spoken to anyone apart from the lady behind the till and my news agents. I hadn't spoken to anyone for 7 days, and I didn't even have much of a conversation with her, because when I walk in, she just reaches up to the fag machine and hands me back. I don't even have to speak. So I've rectified that by going to a different shop, which means I get more exercise and I have to ask for what I want. But yeah, thank you to everyone who expressed concern, but I'm absolutely fine. I mean, there are worthier causes than me.
Sure. But I mean, there's an interesting point to that. And I think I've mentioned this before, Marvin, that I reckon 10 years ago, 20 years ago, maybe 10 years ago, maybe even 5 years ago, in my mind, it wasn't a sliding scale. It was either you were fine or you were having a nervous breakdown, and there was nothing in between. And actually the truth is, it isn't binary, is it?
No, not at all. And as I said, I think that sliding scale is, I guess, how wide the polar opposites are, I guess, depend on the circumstances in your life and how satisfied you are potentially with being in the middle at times, you know? I don't know if that makes sense.
I find that sometimes changing small things can just have a big effect on like my health in a day, and which points towards those kind of that middle ground there. Like, even not so, like when I wake up, I make sure not to check my phone immediately, not go down that rabbit hole of WhatsApp and just kind of lying and scrolling and typing and that. And it's, if I do that in a day and I get up at a certain time, like I've had real struggles just getting up at a regular time in the day, those things can make a big difference. But just accepting those days where you're not great and you're not awful and just having a middle day, in the end, those days become almost as glorious as the great days, because you're like, oh, just before I think that's what depression does to your mind as well. Depression and anxiety just turn it into it's great or it's awful. Like, you want to have those bits in between, and it's just being able to feel those different kinds of emotion again. That is, I know that's a bit of a tangent here, but those are the things that you want to get back to feeling. And I think to anyone out there who's maybe experiencing a real absence of emotion, like, that is a telltale sign of maybe wanting to go and seek help, whether it is from somebody close to them, just somebody that they feel comfortable talking to. And if you are one of the people who feels like they need to be there for someone, I just trying to open up that space. And maybe if they are saying that you're not that person, not taking that personally as well. Like, I know some people around me who have not really been terribly helpful in terms of talking to. One of them told me to, you know, keep smiling. That is a really bad thing to say to anybody who's depressive. You just want to allow them to to be able to kind of feel how they feel. And I think you just want to have somebody who listens to you, even on days when you're just not sure about yourself.
Yeah. I mean, that was sort of what my one of my final questions was exactly, what is the right thing to say and do if a mate or a colleague isn't doing great? You know, I've never struggled with mental health. I don't know, like, for example, Archie, we know each other reasonably well. We're not best friends. I don't know if I was useful or not useful, or if I, you know, I don't know if I sent enough WhatsApps or not enough WhatsApps. Do you know what I mean?
And yeah, I think that's a, but I think being able to accept that you're going to make mistakes as somebody who's talking to like a depressed person. And in the same way that, you know, I know that the moods that I've been in, like, I'm not like, I don't enjoy it. I don't enjoy being in that place, but accepting that there are going to be mistakes made, but as long as you can have as open and honest a conversation with it, then you're going to be able to move forward. But by shutting down, and, you know, there will be, I'm sure, offense made on the part of the person who's trying to help, as in an offense made and offense taken. But just being as open and honest with it is, I think, that the best way forward. I thought you were okay. Is that all right?
Yeah, that's fine. Max, going on personal experience, I can assure you that if you think you've sent too many WhatsApps, you have.
You sent just the right amount, Max.
I'm just going to check how many I sent.
Just checking in. You were checking in a nice amount. Always good.
Marvin, would you echo those sort of those?
Absolutely, yeah. I think it's just about taking each case and each person as each situation as they come, really, and being empathetic, being there for someone. Try not to be overbearing, I would say. I think that's one thing that some people want to help, and sometimes that's not the right situation. You have to just see how the person's feeling different times and just check in on them and just be there for them, really, essentially.
Finally, one for Marvin and Alex. What would you like to see football do next, Alex?
From a purely kind of selfish perspective, in terms of kind of supporting chances, wants and needs, it's about striving for that parity between mental and physical health. And to do that, for me, it's more education. It's being able to go into clubs more often and work with players on a more regular basis in order to improve their emotional literacy and get them into habits around talking about their thoughts and feelings. What Archie was talking about there in terms of his own processes and his daily emotional and mental health maintenance, looking after the small things, starting your day in a certain way. And as Marvin said right at the start of this conversation, you know, treating mental and emotional health like physical health in terms of what am I putting in? You know, what's going into my head today in the same way that you'd think about a diet and physical health. Actually, what's my mental and emotional health diet today? I think if we can start increasing the number of conversations that we're having in clubs, making that more regular, making that part of their lives day in, day out, rather than just one or two education sessions a year, that's a big thing for me in terms of starting change and maintaining change. So that would be my number one, Max, in terms of what I'd like to see from sport and getting not just football, all sports to commit to that. And it's not just about money, it's about time as well, committing their time to helping us to help other people. It's a big one for me.
And Marvin, if anybody's struggling now, what advice would you give them?
I would certainly say to reach out to someone close to them, whether a friend, a family member, colleague, someone that they can feel they can have that conversation with and not be judged. I think that's the biggest thing, is that we fear as human beings is being judged by someone for opening up. To be vulnerable is very difficult. And so that's the reason why we don't do it, because to leave ourselves vulnerable leaves ourselves open to attack that, you know, hurts a lot more than if we had our guard up. So definitely reach out to someone who's close by to you.
Can I just say one more thing?
Yeah, of course.
Just building on a point that Marvin was making there about the conversations that you have with people, if you're the person who's talking to whoever is depressed and anxiety, don't be afraid to just listen. It is not up to you to find the solution. Don't feel pressure in that sense. It is about being able to give the person that space to express themselves, and just from a purely personal perspective, get on the waiting list, and being able to see a therapist has done wonders for me, having that space to do something and add things up. So yeah, just wanted to chip in with that.
Most important point of the day, Archie, absolutely spot on. You know, you think of yourself as a conduit towards further support. How can I be the best conduit? How can I be the best the best passer on of help, really, in the situation that I'm in? And that involves a huge part of that is not having high expectations of yourself in that role. If someone's come to you, if Max, you've if Archie's come to you and asked for help, it's because he's already identified you as being the person that he wants to talk to, and actually, therefore, from your perspective, you've already got everything in your favor. You don't have to do too much. You know, you have to listen, to be yourself, to use your instincts and your strengths, because Archie's already identified those in you by asking for you for help in the first place. Also, get yourself clued up about the support that's available for the individual that you're talking to. And in the vast majority of cases, when we talked about Joe Public, we talked about national helplines that you've already referred to earlier on in this podcast, Max, but also for footballers, it might be internal support within your club, but it's also support and chance services as well. And I'm happy to give you that number as well to put on the website for anyone that needs it following this podcast.
Cool. Thanks, mate. And look, thanks everybody for your time. Really appreciate it. I hope that was useful. It's something we will come back to for sure at some point, but for the time being, Archie, thanks, mate.
Thank you.
Cheers, Marvin.
Thank you.
Alex, thank you.
Thanks.
Cheers, Baz.
You're welcome.
Before we go, just wanted to remind you, in the UK and Ireland, Samaritans can be contacted on 116123, email joe@samaritans.org or joe@samaritans.ie. In the US, the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline, 1-800-273-8255. In Australia, the Crisis Support Service Lifeline, 131114. Other international helplines can be found at befrienders.org. And as we said earlier, we'll include all the links to all those organisations on the Guardian website, and we'll be back on Thursday.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.